In this particular teaching, the shorter discourse on voidness, it was, I think I might have done it before, but it was requested, and one of the nice things about it is it does show just a way that we can especially do our meditation, not perceiving what's there in front of our mind, but noticing what's absent. It gives the perception of absence, what's missing. And that's a very, very important quality to develop in order to progress in one's meditation. Because a lot of times, whatever we're aware of, it's really defined by what is absent, such as the present moment, right now. How do we know it's the present moment? By what is missing, the past and the future. How do we know it's silent? Because of what is missing, all this thinking. And so we develop this perception of what we call emptiness, literally of what's missing. And that really helps our meditation, as you will find. So that's one of the reasons I find it's an amazing sutta, which I'm very happy to read today. So let's start.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami.
So this is the Chulasunyata Sutta, the shorter discourse on voidness. Thus have I heard on one occasion a Blessed One was living at Sarvati in the eastern park in the palace of Megara's mother. Then when it was evening, the Venerable Ananda rose from meditation, went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down on one side and said to the Blessed One. So the monks would usually go into solitude during the daytime after lunch. And if there were going to be any talks or any discussions, these would come in the evening. So Ananda, Venerable Sir, on one occasion a Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country at a town of the Sakyans named Nagarika. There, Venerable Sir, I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Now, Ananda, I often abide in voidness. That's sunyata. The word sunyata is a very well-known word in Buddhism. It was basically taken over by the Mahayana and given a huge prominence in their teachings, but it's obviously very central to the Theravada or the early teachings of the Buddha. Now, Ananda, I often abide in voidness. Did I hear that correctly, Venerable Sir? Did I learn that correctly, attend to that correctly, remember that correctly? Certainly, Ananda, you heard that correctly. Learn that correctly, attend to that correctly, remember that correctly. As formerly, Ananda, so now, I often abide in voidness. Ananda, just as this palace of Megara's mother, who knows whose Megara's mother is? What's her other well-known name? Yes? Visakha, yes. And why was she called Megara's mother when Megara was her husband? That's correct, yes. Because Visakha, she was a Buddhist, and when she was married to this guy Megara, that Megara would not allow her to give alms food, had nothing to do with Buddhism at all. And so, you know, she had to follow what her father, what her husband said, so she could not offer any food. And even though Megara was a very rich man, she just couldn't give any dana. So she wanted to find a good way, a clever way of making it so that she could offer alms again, but without sort of upsetting her husband too much. So what she did when she went to see her friends, when she went to the market, she'd always say, oh, in our home we only eat old food. We only eat old food. And when her husband heard about this on the grapevine, he was very upset. And so he scolded his wife, what do you mean we only eat old food? We get fresh produce every day. And then she had her opportunity. I don't mean like the food we put in our mouths. We just eat old karma. The reason why we're rich and wealthy is because what we did in our previous lives. In this life we're doing nothing at all. We're not making any good karma. We're not giving food to anybody. That's why I say we're just eating the fruits of our old karma, old food. Unfortunately, her husband got it and understood. And from that time on, let his wife offer alms and became a Buddhist himself. And out of gratitude, you know, that there was his wife, he called her my mother in the Dhamma. That's why she's called the mother of Megara, even though she was married to him. And that's Visakha. And the story was that the Megara Mata Prasada, the palace of Megara's mother, I'll just tell you these little anecdotes as we go, because it makes the sutra come alive. Visakha was going to some big festival. She was going out, and so she had, her husband was very wealthy, had his incredibly expensive jewellery. And as she was just going out to some big festival, she think, I'd really like to go and see the Buddha. But, you don't go and see sort of a Buddha or a monk wearing all your finery. So she put it in a bag and sort of gave it to her maid and then went to go and see the Buddha, so she wasn't all dressed up. And when she was listening to a teaching of the Buddha, she was so inspired and so happy that so was her maid. And that when they left the jewellery in the monastery because they forgot it. That's why you should never wear jewellery when you come on a Friday night, because sometimes you might get so inspired you might just leave it here afterwards. But Ananda saw that jewellery. And monks aren't supposed to touch money, you can't handle money, or anything expensive like jewellery. And so he went to see the Buddha. What should I do? Look, there's all this jewellery worth a fortune there. And the Buddha said, in this particular case, if there is any money or any valuable which is lost in the monastery or in this temple here, that's the time the monks can actually pick it up and put it aside for the person who lost it. So that's the time, if I saw $20 anywhere in this compound here, it would be my responsibility to pick it up and to keep it for the person who lost it. Outside of this temple, no, I could not do that. That would be against the rules. So Ananda picked it up and put it aside, and of course she soon remembered she'd lost all this stuff. So she came back and said, did you find it? She said, yeah, here it is, you can take it back. She said, oh my goodness, it's been touched by Ananda, by a holy monk. If it's been touched, I can't take this back. But then if I don't take it back, my husband's going to kill me because losing all this jewellery. So what should I do? So she said, I know what I'll do. I'll buy it back. So she gave a huge donation to the monastery for that jewellery. And she said, now while I'm at it, that donation, can we use it to build a big residence for the community of monks? And the Buddha agreed. And so that was actually where the money came to build what was here called Megara's mother's palace. And I often quote this because sometimes, especially in Sri Lanka, monks aren't allowed to do any physical work at all in many monasteries. Remember one of our monks, he had his kuti, he wanted to paint the wall and they wouldn't allow him to, even though it was just falling apart. He said, no monks, you don't do physical work, you do your meditation, study or preaching. But I always quote this particular story because the money was given for this building, and the Visakha said, can I put Venerable Mahamoggallana in charge of the building project? And the Buddha said, yes, he can be in charge. So even in the time of the Buddha, the monks would be in charge of the building projects. And sometimes it will be on the scaffold, it will be laying bricks. That's actually written in the ancient texts. But they do actually say that because Mahamoggallana was in charge of the building, it got built so incredibly quickly. And that's because Mahamoggallana was one of the greatest proponents of psychic powers. Brick, there. You don't need cranes, piece of wood. So that was the story why that particular palace was built incredibly quickly. And it became one of the residences of the Buddha. So that's Megara's palace of Megara's mother. Megara's mother's palace. So here we go. Ananda, just as this palace of Megara's mother, which is just a big building where the monks would stay, is void of elephants, cattle, horses and mares, void of gold and silver, void of the assembly of men and women, and there is present only this voidness, named the singleness dependent upon the Sangha of Bhikkhus. So too, so I'll just stay there, stop there for a moment. You see, what the whole perception is here, this is a monastic building, so there's nothing which is concerned with the town, with the city, with the village. There's no people, there's no, we would say these days, cars and bicycles. There's no cars, there's no bicycles, there's no TVs, there's no radios, there's no couches, no gold and silver. This is a place for the Sangha. So all that worldly stuff is absent, and the only thing which is present, only this known voidness, namely the singleness dependent upon the Sangha of bhikkhus. It's just a monk's place. And so it's a perception of just no town stuff, just monk stuff. Not attending to the perception of village, not attending to the perception of people, so too, a monk not attending to the perception of a village, not attending to the perception of people, attends to the singleness depending on the perception of forest. His mind enters into that perception of forest and acquires confidence, steadiness, the word should be release. I'll talk about this in a moment. He understands thus, whatever disturbances or afflictions there might be dependent upon the perception of a village, those are not present here. Whatever disturbances there might be or afflictions there might be dependent upon the perception of people, those are not here. There is only present this amount of affliction or disturbance, namely the singleness dependent upon the perception of forest. Now, once you get to understand the framework here, you can understand how this goes right through with the whole of the meditation. So like a monk staying in the forest, say Bodhinyana, or you go and stay in Jhana Grove, or you go and stay in Dharmasala, Nuns Monastery. There you've only got the perception of Sangha, of forest. All that stuff which is of the world there is void of those perceptions. That's one of the reasons why people like and enjoy living in a monastery for a few days, or going to Jhana Grove, because it's void of many perceptions. And those perceptions here are called like disturbances, I call it afflictions. And it's only just the one affliction left, the affliction of the perception of the forest. Later on we'll find out why that's a disturbance or an affliction. Disturbance, affliction means disturbance, it's a disturbance of peace. Affliction is a disturbance of happiness. Yes. No, perception is that whenever you're looking at me, you can be looking at me as a monk, as a man, as old. There's many, many different aspects of one particular perception, one particular conscious moment. And we choose only just one or two of those facets of this conscious moment. And what we choose, that's called our perception. So you can perceive to see me as a monk if you wish to. That's the one facet. Or you can think of me as English. That might be one facet. Maybe think as old or middle aged, because you know you're older than me, so not so old. So it depends on which particular facet you decide to perceive. That's why that some people can look at somebody and say, wow, she's really beautiful. Another person say, no, she's ugly. One person can say, you know, was it one man's meat is another man's poison? So it's the same article of flesh, but we perceive it in different ways. It's what we choose of all the possible ways of looking at things for you to take up. More? Not so rarefied, because we do this all the time. That's a really good question. So now I perceive that as a good question. Another person might say, here he goes again. Somebody else might perceive it as saying, oh, you know, that's sort of interesting, but, you know, let's get on. So those perceptions, just the way that one or two or three particular aspects of one experience which we choose to focus on and bring to our mind. Does that make sense? Perception? Yeah, I think so, because here it is a really good question. It is because we have so many things to perceive, like in sort of Migawa Mata's palace. What are we going to perceive? We're going to perceive this is a big building. This is, you know, got the floor, the ceiling. What are we going to perceive in there? He said, if you're going to practice the way of voidness, of sunyata, you look at what is missing. Now here you are sort of, you know, staying in Bodhinyana Monastery. What's missing from here, from your ordinary life? Yeah, indeed. It's just what's there. You're attending to things which are missing. So you're seeing what's missing in this room. You know, what is usually here but is not here today. Okay. It's not an understanding way yet, it's just the way one has been training oneself to perceive in such a way which would lead to very deep meditation. And I mentioned a bit, I think, earlier that the present moment, you know, when you're in the present moment, this first stage of the meditation method which I teach, how do you know it's the present moment? You know, because that thing which is called the past, that experience which is called the future, is not there anymore. It's something which is very common to you, it's not there. Now you may have a sickness, chronic fatigue. And then one day, a miracle, you get up in the morning, you feel, well, you're so good. You feel energized. You say, wow, something's missing. You know, that tiredness, that sort of yuckiness is gone. So that's like a perception of something which is missing. Yes, that's right. But this is actually you're training yourself not just to attend to what's actually there, you know, not just in the fact, oh, I feel really good. You also attend to what's not there. And it's a different way of perceiving. That's right, yes. The tadpole going to the frog, and the frog standing by the side of the lake, he realized something is missing, water. And that's a very good point, because that gives you the method of actually seeing, not just getting to deep meditation, but getting some enlightenment going as well. So he uses this straight away, that when you're in the forest, you can train yourself to notice what's missing in that forest. No mobile phones, no sort of sound of traffic, no sort of people coming and going, no TVs blaring. You know, like where you live, there's no noise of people shuffling backwards and forwards. So you notice what's missing, not just what's there. And there's present only this amount of disturbance, namely the singleness dependent upon the perception of forest. When everything else is gone, what's left is that singleness of what's left. He understands this field. Oh no, I was going to go back to this statement here, which is comes very, very frequently. Not an argument, but a very strong discussion with Bhikkhu Bodhi, that his mind enters into that perception, acquires confidence, steadiness, and release. Now, this is actually a terrible translation of this, and this is an important part of the way the mind works. It doesn't enter, it leaps onto it. The word actually, is used for the way that animals leap in the forest. So it's like the mind jumps onto this perception, acquires confidence. Now that's an important psychological part of the meditation, because you're happy to be there. You know, you're not afraid to stay there. Confidence is not just lack of fear, it also has a bit of joy in it. The word is pasadati. And it's a play on words there, because the palace is a pasada, is a place of joy. And this is here that he acquires joy, confidence, in that perception, which means it sustains itself. And I mentioned that even yesterday in the meditation. Once you have any perception, and you've leapt onto it because you recognize it's an old friend, you gain a sense of joy and confidence, you're at ease with it. And then what happens next? Steadiness. That's a good translation. Steadiness literally means you sit there. And decision is, that's the one I really argued against. It does not mean that. It means release. There was two words. This actually, group of four words, occurs about 80 or 90 times in the whole Pali Tripitaka. And one day I went through all of them. It took me a long time. And in all of that, I think in about all except one, they used the word vimucchati. And in the first one they had adimucchati. Adinvacati does mean decision, but that was obviously an error by the purple person who wrote this down, because every other case, 99% of the times, it has release or freedom. And so that, you know, Rhea is pushing hard to have that change. So his mind leaps onto that perception, acquires joy and confidence there, settles there, and finds release, a sense of freedom. And it's very important to get those four things right. The freedom is also important. Yeah. You're freedom from those afflictions. You're free from those afflictions. Going back to present moment awareness. Free from the past and the future. Oh, you're so free. So taking that present moment awareness, it's void of the past and the future. Now, once you've been practicing meditation a lot, presently you start, you just want to get there. Your mind leaps onto it. Present moment again, yeah! So it leaps onto it, finds joy there and confidence, no fear at all. Just, this is a great old place, I've been there before. You settle in there. It takes, you know, even for myself, a few seconds to settle yourself so the past and the future don't come and bother you anymore. And then you find this beautiful sense of release and peace. And that is part of every stage of meditation. Yes, depends what I've been doing. So I'll be careful because I don't want to state any old personal attainments. So he understands this field of perception is void of the perception of village, the field of perception is void of the perception of people, there is present only this non-voidness, namely the singleness dependent upon the perception of Ferris. Thus he regards it as void of what is not there, and to what remains he understands that which is present in us, this is present. Thus Ananda, this is his genuine, undistorted, pure descent into a voidness. Not descent as it's a lower state, like going into the voidness. Now this actually sets the tone of what comes next. That's why I lingered on this particular point, because we've got a lot of repetition here of the different stages of this process. And the Buddha is brilliant in this sutta because he takes something which is so ordinary, just the difference between being in the forest and being in town, and just say, in the forest, you're perceiving just this. You know this is just this. This is present. I'm in a forest. But you also know it's empty of all this busyness of being in town with family and TV and phones and going to work and traffic. Now that is a pure understanding of voidness. Now is that clear, that whole method? I have laboured it, but there was a point to labouring it. You descend into it, which means you fall into it. That is a nice little metaphor there. In the same way, when you fall into a hole, you don't have to sort of put forth effort into your falling. It just happens without your effort, which is a descending into it, going into it. Yes, Bonner. The peace of emptiness. Yeah, this is one of the, that's that. In any empty situation, in other words, when something is missing, so for example, this weekend you may have the perception that you are void of having to go to work today. And there's only present this. It's weekend. So your mind jumps onto the fact this is weekend. It's no work time. And this moment is void of work. And that is a valid perception of emptiness, which should give you a lot of peace and happiness. You're free of the disturbance and affliction of having to be at work. You get the method here? Now, a lot of times, for people, like maybe after by Sunday, you just take it for granted. So, you know, you lose the happiness of being on holiday because you forget what you're free of. I've often noticed this when, you know, I've been sick. You never feel more healthy than just after you recover from a sickness. And now why is that? Because the first day or two after you've recovered from a sickness, Now you have the perception of being void of sickness. And that perception of being void of sickness, the sickness is over, the pain is gone, I'm out of hospital. That gives you a lot of peace and happiness. But after a few days, you don't notice that anymore. You just take it for granted. You have no perception of what's missing. You're just back to ordinary life again. So the perception of the affliction which is gone is a source of happiness. And it's also a perception which is a powerful tool to take you into deep meditations and also enlightenment. Let's try number two. Oh, yeah. Ah, okay. We're just coming to this soon because we're going stage by stage into different levels of emptiness. Okay. Now we go here to the perceptions. Oh, this is actually fascinating because you go to the straight to the perception of things and then know things. So we've gone to just forest and apart from busyness of village life. And paragraph 5, again, Ananda, a monk or a meditator, not attending to the perception of people, not attending to the perception of forest, so even letting go of that perception of being in the forest, you attend to the singless, to the singless dependent on the perception of earth. Now we're talking about earth here, we're talking about just of a thing, of substance. So let's, instead of calling earth, just call it substance. So it tends to the thing must depend upon the perception of substance. His mind enters into that perception of substance and acquires confidence, leaps into that perception and acquires confidence, steadiness, and released. Just as a bull's hide becomes free from foals when fully stretched with 100 pegs, so too, a monk not attending to any of the ridges and hollows of this earth, to the rivers and ravines, the tracks of stumps and thorns, the mountains and even places, attends to the singleness dependent upon the perception of a substance. But even his mind enters into that perception of substance and acquires joy, steadiness, and release. He understands thus, whatever disturbance there might be depend upon the perception of people, those are not present here. That was overcome earlier. Whatever disturbance there might be depend upon the perception of forest, that is not present here. That's just been overcome. There is present only this amount of disturbance, namely the singleness depend upon the perception of substance. He understands, this field of perception is void of the perception of people. It's void of the perception of forest. There is present only this non-voidness, namely the singleness depend upon the perception of substance. Thus he regards it as void of what is not there. But as to what remains, he understands that which is present thus, this is present. In other words, just the perception of this substance. This, Ananda, too, is his genuine, undistorted, pure descent into voidness. And I mention that substance because now we go straight into the immaterial realms. It's almost like a bypass of the jhanas. Into equanimity, each one of those states has a sense of equanimity, but equanimity is not the main point here. It's just that here we're getting to a perception of substance, again, losing the simile of stretching a hide, with no variation. So it's a singleness, a smooth and even perception, which because of that, could sort of take you into these jhanas and go almost directly. Remember what I once said in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond? It's the force of letting go which you enter those jhanas, then you can go straight through the first, second jhana and go deeper into the interior chambers of the mind. Giving a simile that the mind is like a room with many chambers, but the next chamber is inside the one you are in right now, like a concentric circles of walls. And as you go through the outside one, and you go to the next innermost one, the next innermost one. So this is propelling you very quickly into the deep center of the mind, the immaterial places. certainly one has to be equanimous, because there has to be, again, that sense of being void of all these, the metaphor of the folds and the wrinkles in the bull's hide means that there's such a singleness of perception of just substance that that will disappear. When you have a singleness of perception which is sustained for a long time, it's the same as when you first came in here, you may have been aware of the sound of the fans, but because that sound never changed, that you could not perceive it anymore. And now that I've told you about that sound, now you can hear it again. However, anything, any sensual object for any of the five senses which is sustained for long periods of time, the brain will not be able to recognize it, will not notice it anymore. In the same way, a singleness of perception, which is even, just like this substance, which has hardly got any qualities to it except just thingness, then that soon might disappear. And when it does disappear, then you get into this next stage. So you take something, it's still, and then it vanishes. So as what Chris was saying, you don't put any effort into this, effort will actually cause disturbance, which means the thing won't disappear. So, go on, yeah? No, it actually disappears totally, so you can't even hear it, you can't feel it, you don't know it anymore. It doesn't register. So, again, Ananda, a monk not attends to the perception of forest, not attends to the perception of earth, attends to the singleness dependent on the perception of the base of infinite space. Now, if you remember last week, that perception of infinite space is the first of the immaterial attainments. And to make that more easy to understand, I changed allowably, instead of calling it infinite space, unbounded or unmeasured space. And I use the word unbounded or unmeasured, unlimited, because again, I brought up the simile which most of you will have of present moment awareness. I use that simile because it's a beginning stage of meditation which you all would know. In that state of present moment awareness, time has no boundary anymore. In one sense, if you look at it from one angle, that you're squashed in this tiny sliver of time. You know, between the mass of the past and the eternity of the future. And it's this tiny point in time. So you're squashed, as it were. But so it's hardly no time at all. But then, the experience of present moment awareness is like you've got all the time in the world. In one sense, experientially I'm talking about, it's like an infinity of time in the present moment. And that's why when you really get into that type of meditation, it's what it feels like. You can meditate for half an hour, 2 hours, and you don't notice it. It's just timeless. So that description there, like, of no time, infinite time, timeless, gives you an understanding of what it means here about infinite space. Like space which defines things. He's just gone. It doesn't have any meaning anymore because it's not measured. Now, hopefully you get that idea to give you an understanding of what these perceptions are. It means that something is disappearing again. The idea of like extension, duration, size, thing, it's gone. Yes. Okay, so we'll go further, because it repeats this many, many times, so it gets you, as we repeat it, you get the understanding even better. So his mind enters the perception of the base of unlimited space or unmeasured space, you acquire joy and lack of fear, steadiness and release. You release from those old perceptions which were afflictions. You understand thus, whatever disturbances or afflictions there might be depend upon the perception of forest, these are not present here. Whatever disturbances or afflictions there might be depend upon the perception of stuff, substance, those are not present here. There is present only this amount of disturbance, namely the singleness dependent upon the perception of the base of unlimited space. He understands this field of perception is void of the perception of forest. It's void of the perception of earth, of substance. It's void. There is presence only this non-voidness, namely the singleness dependent upon the perception of the base of unmeasured space. Or you might say what I said last week, of vanishing space. Thus he regards it as void of what's not there, but as to what remains, he understands that which is present. Thus, this is present, so you understand what's there, but you understand that that is literally defined by what is missing. The present moment is defined by the lack of the past and the future. You understand what's there, you understand what's missing. Thus, Ananda, this too is his genuine, undistorted, pure descent into voidness. Again, Ananda, not attended to the perception of earth, not attended to the perception of the base of unmeasured space. You attend to the singleness dependent on the perception of unmeasured consciousness. Now you're getting into some really nice stuff now. And this is not just theoretical stuff, this is what happens. Your mind enters upon into that perception of that base of unmeasured consciousness, and you acquire this confidence, this joy, steadiness, you stay there and you feel free. You understand whatever disturbances there might be depend upon that perception of earth. They're not present there. You don't know substance anymore. It's gone. Whatever disturbance there might be depend upon the perception of the base of unlimited stuff, things. That's not present here. There is present only this amount of disturbance, namely the singleness dependent on the perception of the base of vanishing consciousness, unmeasured consciousness. I said vanish because, again, going back to the symbol, the metaphor of the present moment awareness, time is vanishing in that point. Thus they regard it as void of what is not there, but as to what remains there, they understand that which is present. This is present. Thus, Ananda, this too is his genuine, undistorted, pure descent into voidness. Again, Ananda, I mean, when consciousness vanishes, what's left? Nothing. Again, Ananda, monk or meditator, not attending to the perception of the base of unmeasured space, not attending to the perception of unmeasured consciousness, attends to the singleness, and by the way, if you don't measure things, they vanish. That's another important trick in meditation. Not to measure things. Because when you measure things, you create them. That's one of the... was that story of Lord Kelvin. Somebody here, years and years and years ago, reminded me of the great British philosopher and scientist, Lord Kelvin, which many people, if you remember your even high school physics, a Kelvin scale of temperature going down to 0 degrees, which is absolute zero. -273 degrees centigrade. Still got a good memory from my science days. That's absolute zero in centigrade, but zero in the Kelvin scale. And he was also a philosopher of science, and he is quoted as saying, the only way we can control nature is to first learn how to measure her accurately, first of all. That's the birth of technology. Technology required accurate measurements. Now, the accurate meter rule, the accurate sort of gram weight, now, the accurate clock, and only when you had those measurements very, very refined, then we could actually control nature and create the technology which we know today. And when they made that quote, of course, I like turning these things around. Yeah, it's true, you have to learn how to measure accurately first before you can control things. That's why the government wants to get all of your details to measure you, and then they can control you. And that's why, you know, people with human rights or civic freedoms, they always resist, you know, giving all of your details. Because if they don't know who you are, where you are, how much you earn, there's no way of controlling you. And I've used that to the way of you meditate. When you don't measure your mind, you can't control her. When you can't control, it means you let it go. You let it be. So if you say good meditation, bad meditation, and you're controlling from that point, you've measured, now you can control. Bad meditation, you've got to make it better. Good meditation, you've got to make it more good. Whenever you measure, there is control. The person you live with, if you measure them, they're like this, it's their good points, this is their bad points, the next thing is you'll start controlling them. If you don't know who they are, you stop measuring them. There's no way you can control. Now that's a powerful point in meditation. So when you don't measure the mind, good, bad, who knows? Then you're free. You have nothing to do. Don't know where I'm going, nothing to do. So you stand still, you don't go anywhere. You're still. That's one of the problems. The way I teach all these stages, people want to measure themselves. How far are they along? Are they close to jhana yet? Are they close to enlightenment? What particular stage? Are you a stream winner, once returned, another arahant? As soon as you start to measure, you've lost it. You start to control. And from control, that's how you build craving and ego. Not measuring. That's really powerful. So you can see here, when you don't measure consciousness, it's gone. That's what it means, infinite. It means unmeasured. It vanishes. It just drops out of existence. You have created consciousness by measuring things. Now it's gone. Not attending. No, that's... And not attending is just what happens, it's not what you do. So you don't say, I am now going to attend to this, I'm not going to attend to that. You just find that your attention is just not on there anymore. So it's a natural occurrence, not a deliberate act. So let's go. Paragraph 7 again. Again, Ananda, a meditator, not attentive perception of stuff, not attentive perception of the base of of unmeasured space, attends to the... Oh no, I did the consciousness one. Yeah, I'll go to number 8, I think. That's right, isn't it? Yeah, okay, number 8. Again, Ananda, a meditator, not attentive to perception of the base of unmeasured space, not attentive to perception of unmeasured consciousness, attends to the sin must depend upon the perception of the base of nothingness. Space and consciousness have vanished. What's left? This is nothing, but that is something you're attending to. It's a perception, it's a singleness. It's a perception of nothingness. The mind enters into that perception of the base of nothingness. So number one, that's a perception. The mind is still active. It's knowing something. And what is it knowing? You ask afterwards, it was a nothingness. You acquire confidence and joy. So it is with a sense of pleasure, only very refined, obviously, different than one normal idea of pleasure. Steadiness, and you feel release there, the peace of release. You understand thus, so this is not void of mindfulness. It's not a sort of a trance state, a state of unconsciousness, state of you, and unconsciousness is normal word, normal meaning. You understand whatever disturbances or afflictions there might be depend upon the perception of the base of unmeasured space. Those aren't present here. Whatever disturbances or afflictions there might be depend upon the perception of the base of unmeasured consciousness. Those are not present either. There is present only this amount of disturbance, namely the singleness depend upon the perception of the base of nothingness. He understands this field of perception is void of the perception of unmeasured space. It's void of the perception of unmeasured consciousness. It's void. It's only present. It's only this non-voidness, namely the singleness, dependent upon the perception of the base of nothingness. Thus he regards it as void of what is not there. But as to what remains, he understands that which is present in us. This is present. So you understand what's present. That present is just this state of nothingness. Thus Ananda, this too is his genuine, undistorted, pure descent into voidness, sunyata. Again, Ananda, a meditator not attending to perception of the base of unmeasured consciousness, not attending to the base of nothingness, entertains to the singleness dependent upon the perception of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Now that might appear to be gobbledygook to you. It's a perception of neither perception nor non-perception. It's supposed to be such an oxymoron that most people, if they didn't realize this was just the only way you can describe one of the most refined, if not the most refined experience available to a human mind. But that is a perfect description. That's what it's like. As I said before, look back upon it one way. Yeah, you're perceiving. Look back on another way. What you're perceiving was no perceiving. So your mind enters upon into that perception of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And you acquire this joy, confidence, this steadiness and release from all the other afflictions. You understand thus, whatever disturbances there might be depend upon the perception of the base of unmeasured consciousness. Those aren't present here. Whatever disturbances there might be depend upon the perception of nothingness. Those are not present here. There is only this amount of disturbance, namely the singleness dependent on the perception of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. He understands this field of perception is void of the perception of the base of vanishing consciousness. It's void the perception of the base of nothingness. There is present only this non-voidness, namely the singleness dependent upon the perception, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Thus he regards it as void of what is not there. But as to what remains there, he understands that which is present thus. This is present. You understand what's present. Thus Ananda, this too is a genuine, undistorted, pure descent into voidness. And again Ananda, a meditator not attending to the perception of the base of nothingness, not even attending to the perception of the base of neither perception nor non-perception, attains to the singleness dependent upon the signless concentration of the mind. His mind attends into that signless concentration of mind and acquires confidence, steadiness and release. He understands us. Whatever disturbances there might be depend on the perception of that base of nothingness. Those are not present here. Whatever disturbance there might be dependent upon the perception of the base of neither perception or non-perception, those are not present here. This is present only, this amount of disturbance, namely that connected with the six bases that are dependent on this body, conditioned by life. Now this is fascinating. The six bases, the six sense bases that are dependent upon this body and conditioned by life, those are the six senses. He understands his field of perception is void of perception, the base of nothingness. Perception void of the perception, the base of neither perception, non-perception. There is present only there's present only this non-voidness, namely that connected with the six bases that are dependent upon this body and conditioned by life. Thus he regards as void of that which is not there, but as to what remains there, he understands that which is present. This is present. Now that is a very difficult thing to understand, but it can only mean that when the base of neither perception nor non-perception disappears, that is always a cessation of perception and feeling. So he understands, obviously, through each one of these things, the mind needs to move to have that understanding, that this is the state of cessation. The mind has ceased, but he knows afterwards that what was left were the six bases that depend upon this body and conditioned by life. He was still alive, the body was just there, but all the perception had stopped, the mind had stopped, but there was something left. So yet it was void of, the signless concentration of mind, nothing left. The signless concentration of the mind the Animitta Samadhi. This is called the Animitta Samadhi. It is the state of stillness. Samadhi is a state of stillness. It is exactly the same as the state of cessation of the mind, but it's called the signless because the way you attain that, the way you enter that, is by not attending to what's there, but attending to what's absent. So you're not looking at the things, you're looking at what's absent. And so what's absent becomes your mode of travel into that state. You get to that same state of cessation of mind through two other ways. There's the animitta, which is what we have here. There is the, what's the other two? Panihata is one of them, which is because of, I think that's one depending on impermanence. That you use impermanence, that things aren't stable. And there is the third one. What's the other one? The animitta, apanihita, and... Sorry? No, this is from the non-self one. Anyway, I'll remember that later on. But this goes to the same place, but it depends upon the path into that same place of cessation. And the person knows that that was cessation of the mind, but the body and its six senses were still there in the sense when you come out, the six senses will be back again. Correct. Just the attitude, yes. Now, you say this works just as well as Anapanasati, the mindfulness on the breath method. But as you've heard me say before in the retreats, and you've heard me say this, it doesn't matter, tinker's cuss, as I used to say. In other words, it doesn't matter at all what particular method you use. It's what really matters is actually just what you are, the way you relate to those methods, as long as you're making peace, being kind, being gentle, as long as you really are letting go. Because the breath is just what happens as you go into these stages. So you don't actually do breath meditation. Breath meditation is what happens when you start letting go. Yeah. No, Daniel, that's it. You would indeed. This is just the things which are gone through pretty quickly. I did give the siblings that when you go into a house, if you run pretty quickly, you go through these beginning stages very fast. So you have to go through them. If you're going to Serpentine, you know, even if you go in a sort of a jet from Nolomau to Serpentine, you still have to go through all the suburbs on the way. You can't suddenly disappear from Nolomau and suddenly appear in Serpentine. You may go through them so quickly you may not notice that you're going through them. Yes. The breath becomes a whole breath. And the reason this happens naturally is because as you start to let go, you stop measuring things, or in this particular case, you're attending to sort of what's missing, that things disappear. So first of all, it's a natural path. This is not just what you do, this is actually what happens. Time disappears first. Thinking then disappears first. When the biggest obstacles which we attend to, you know, what really sort of dominates most of our brain, disappears, what is actually left? What is actually moving? And if there's no sound outside and your body's, you know, reasonably comfortable, your breath is moving. I still remember years and years ago, 26 years ago, when Ajahn Chakra was the abbot here and I was number two monk, there was a group here in Perth got the very first flotation chamber in Perth. And there was this little box here which they filled with salt water. It must have had some airflow in it, but it was soundproof, it was absolutely dark, it was a sensory deprivation chamber. And they came and said, "Can you two monks, can you try our sensory deprivation chamber? We just got it, you know, we want to let you have a go." And of course, seniority meant Ajahn Chakra got there first. So he went in there, and then when he came out afterwards, I asked him what it was like. And it'd be really great for meditation, because you don't have to have any worry about your legs, you know, and being sore, because you're just floating there. And no possibility of dogs barking, because it's absolutely soundproof, really dark. Well, that was obviously a great place. And he said, no, actually, he could hear his breathing. He said, that was just so noisy, because everything else was taken away, and that was the only thing which was left. And unfortunately, I never got to have a go. The reason is because the next day we saw in the newspaper, I think it was in the West Australian, an advertisement. Flotation chamber, as used by Buddhist monks. We were conned. He got us to go in there so he could put it on the advertisement. That we used it. We couldn't argue with him because we didn't use it. Well, he did anyway. So I never got to go in there. But anyway, I mention that story because when everything else disappears, his breathing is actually quite loud. So as things disappear, yeah, you do come to the breathing. That's all that's left. It's a natural. And as you settle down, the breathing gets very smooth and even, and then it disappears. Now for those of you who do this, you can use this discourse on voidness, you can extend it. When the breathing disappears, what do? You have that perception of the voidness of breath. And you leap onto that. You've got confidence in it. You're not afraid that you're going to die. Which means you can stay there, get the steadiness, and feel this beautiful sense of relief. And it's not just the breath which disappears at this stage, that's the last part of your body. And with the sense of release, you're free from your body. So when the breath does disappear, now after a while, all you need to do is to train the perception that, yeah, it's gone. And the perception, the only single that's left, is the perception of the voidness of breath. Now many people have asked that question in meditation. The breath has disappeared, what do I look at? What am I going to watch? The voidness of breath. Now once you get your head around that, it becomes a very powerful way of helping your meditation. Once you get your head around that, you can sort of jump onto it, get this confidence, steadiness, and feel release from your body. And then you go deeper as these things disappear, little by little. Meditation is a great vanishing act. The whole world is vanishing, including you. That's brilliant. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay, yeah. Now a base again is an English word trying to have this, for this Pali word, dhatu. Dhatu just means, it can be a thing, but it can be an immaterial thing. So it is just a way of describing something which exists in the world. As you can say, of nothingness, but that is actually a thing. Not a thing in the sense of something you can touch, but something you can experience. It's a base only in the sense that around that base you can actually get this perception of nothingness, or get that perception of emptiness or nothingness or infinite space. It is something which is, the Buddha was in his philosophy, was saying, look, in order to understand the world, you know, we have to have categories. You might even call it a category. Now that might be a really interesting translation of that word dhatu, category, set. You know, like in the idea of math, sets. They don't have any real existence other than, you know, what we add to it in the mind. So what the Buddha is really trying very hard to do, and very careful, not to say like a thing, an eternal entity, but just like a category, a state, a base, which is not supposed to be permanent, everlasting. And this is, in the same sense, they also have like the base of the unborn. And sometimes people say the realm, there is a realm of an unborn, an unoriginated. And they add a meaning there which was never really intended by the ancient Pali. It's not as like a thing, it's just like a category. Like love is a dhatu, is a base of love. And what does it actually mean there? It's just a way of getting that sort of emotion which you can recognize and getting some way to be able to conceive of it, work with it, and create language around it. No. It's not that good. Yes. I'm glad that actually we read these out, because as you get to know our Buddhism more and more, you get to understand the framework, what actually these really mean. Because it is different than an English language, as is Chinese, has a different framework for understanding the world. And every different language, Western languages, European languages, they all come from a common core, so there's hardly any difference there. There's only very small differences. When you get to an Asian language, or hear an ancient Asian language, you get like the concepts which are embedded in that language, you get to get a feel for, and they are quite important to understand what the Buddha was actually saying. So translations sometimes miss, but when you read translation after translation after translation after translation, you actually get the picture. Okay, we'll go on a little bit further. I'm glad you're getting into this. Number 11, paragraph 11, we've already gone to this space of mind ceasing through signlessness. Again, Ananda, a monk not attending to the perception of the base of nothingness, not attending to the perception of the category of neither perception nor non-perception, attends to the singleness dependent upon the signless concentration of mind. The mind enters into that signless concentration of mind, acquires confidence, steadiness, and release. They understand thus. That cessation of the mind, that sinus concentration of the mind, is conditioned and volitionally produced. The mind has gone towards that. But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. And everything that cessation comes back again. In other words, the mind turns on again. When he knows and sees thus, the mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, and from the taint of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes a knowledge. It is liberated. You understand. Birth is destroyed. The whole life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. So that is when that very refined state of cessation. And in other suttas, they say when a person has attained to that degree of cessation, described in paragraph 10, and they emerge afterwards, there's only one or two possibilities, either fully enlightened or a state of a non-returner. And the reason why one is not fully enlightened, if one comes out of that state, one still, as it were, attaches to that state as the ultimate. There is still the attachment to thinking that that is the real me. That is the ultimate. That is God. That is everything. And that is overcome by saying that that too is conditioned, produced, impermanent, subject to cessation. So even the very highest of attainments is not considered to be a permanent entity. Do you get that? So that means that there's nothing at all, not even the most refined meditation attainment you could ever achieve, not even that you can hang the hat of a God, of a being, of an ultimate destination. So that means you let go of everything. That's when everything is destroyed. No more birth. Yes. It is the habit, but there is that attachment, that stickiness to those incredibly refined and beautiful states. Not the view, yeah, but the view is perfect, but at the time there is. If there wasn't any even thought, perception of a self, there would never be any stickiness left. So the view is perfected, but the perceptions and thoughts still have to be dragged into line, which stops them from being the full Arahant. This is a great place to hang out. So they hang out there. But when you fully understand it, and you even let go of those most refined states, then you are liberated and it comes to knowledge. And it's interesting here, just to point out, this is an interesting translation. When you know and see thus, your mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the, you see, the outflowing of being, from the outflowing of delusion. When it is liberated, there comes a knowledge, it is liberated. Now you never say, I am liberated. Just a small little point there to notice. You don't say, when I am liberated, there comes a knowledge, I am liberated. You say, it is liberated. You know it's liberated. You understand, not I'm an Arahat. You understand, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done, there's no more coming to any state of being. And please note on the impersonality of that, so those statements. It's not a personal attainment anymore. There's no person involved at all. It's just what had to be done has been done. It is liberated. And after that liberation, they understand thus. Whatever their disturbances there might be depend upon the outflowing due to sensual desire. Those are not present. Whatever disturbances or afflictions there might be depend upon the outflowing of being. And this is, you know, just to go out there, just to be. Those are not present there. Whatever disturbances or afflictions there might be depend upon the outflowing due to delusion. Those are not present there. There is present only this amount of disturbance, namely that connected with the six bases that are dependent on one's body and conditioned by life. In other words, just, you know, the life which is continuing on till you fully enter Parinibbana at the end of your life. You understand that this field of perception is void of the outflowing of sensual desire, the field of perception is void of the outflowing of being, this field of perception is void of the outflowing of delusion. There is present only this non-voidness, namely that connected with the six bases that are dependent upon this body and conditioned by life. Thus he regards it as void as what is not there, but as to what remains there, he understands that which is present thus. This is present. Thus, Ananda, this is his genuine, undistorted, pure descent into voidness. This is the supreme and unsurpassed perception of voidness. Basically, that you are enlightened. There's no more birth, and all there is there left is this body just continuing on until the end of this life, and when that stops, everything stops. That's the only thing which is left. Everything else is void, gone. So that's the supreme sunyata, the supreme emptiness. Sorry, yeah. Pure descent into voidness. Ananda, whatever recluses and Brahmins in the past entered upon and abide in pure, supreme, unsurpassed voidness, all entered upon and abide in the same pure, supreme, unsurpassed voidness. Whatever recluses and Brahmins in the future, whatever recluses and Brahmins in the present, enter upon and abide in the pure, supreme, unsurpassed voidness, all enter upon and abide in the same pure, supreme voidness. Therefore, Ananda, you should train yourself. We will enter upon and abide in pure, supreme, unsurpassed voidness. That's what the Blessed One said. Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. That's a lovely sutta, quite profound, actually incredibly profound. But hopefully you get the picture. You notice how much in life we always notice things. What's there? But here, the meditator develops the perceptions of what's absent. And as Bongwin pointed out, that old simile which I've used so many times, which is a very fine simile of the tadpole can never know what water is until it becomes a frog and jumps out on the lake. And then, if the frog is a stupid frog, it still won't know what water is. But if it knows the perception of voidness, you think, hang on, there's something which was there, but now it's gone. I am free of the perception of water. So that state of dry land is void of water. And that's the only time you know what water is. And know it's an affliction. It's only when you stay long enough in the forest that you know just the affliction of living in town. It's only when you go into, say, you know, a deeper meditation, when the body disappears, only then do you know the affliction of a body. This is how you let go of things. The only reason we have attachment to things is because we think there's something in it for us and it's pleasurable and it's not really an affliction. So this becomes a descent into emptiness. And the other point I make here is one of the differences between this concept of emptiness and that used in Mahayana is this is practical, not philosophical. This is always emptiness of something. Not emptiness without something to tie the emptiness down to. This is a practical emptiness. You're empty of the perception of town, you're empty of body, you're empty of breath, you're empty of time. It's always empty of something. And that is a great distinction between this early Buddhist idea of emptiness and that which came later, where emptiness was untied from everything, just became a thing in itself. Emptiness. Empty of what? Empty of even emptiness. But that became a later thing. This is far more practical. Sometimes it's nice to play around, you know, with that in your mind, but it doesn't really get you anywhere. It's much easier to know what you're empty of, what is actually missing. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's not really... Yeah, go on. It's not bypassing jhana. You can't bypass jhana to enter the immaterial realms. It's just you use this almost like this vehicle to take a run at jhanas. And you take a run and you go so fast into it. You just go through the first, second, third and fourth really quickly to enter the immaterial. Yeah, you know, it's just, you never try to go through even the jhanas. You just let go more and more. You make peace, be kind, be gentle, more and more. And this is just what happens. It's just a substance. You've got a good point there. Now, you could be looking at the kasinas and using those to get into jhanas. And actually, you're probably correct there. So thank you for that, because that's exactly the same what I was talking about, but I never sort of added the kasina meditation to that. The substance stuff, because remember when you have a kasina, now you're looking at something and you're getting its essence. So if it's water, it's not just water, it's just its essence, because you need something very simple and very steady for the mind to focus on. And it does get into jhanas very quickly. So that would be a valid kasina method. So thank you, Cheng, for noticing that. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, the most usual kasinas would be the kasinas on like the discs or light, the colours, which is more common. So I'll use that because that's something I'm more used to. You get like a colour, like a yellow kasina, just you draw this, or you usually get this little yellow disc and you look at it, stare on it, and you close your eyes until you can imagine it, and then you can't imagine it very long, you open your eyes until you can actually hold it in your mind, a visualization of a very simple disc. And usually what happens, it has to be simple, without any sort of folds and evenness of colours, not a light part, not a dark part. So it's that the idea of having no wrinkles, no valleys, no mountains, no rivers, is like an evenness of that image. Which, you know, you have the outside image of Earth, and then you have your idea of Earth. I'd say the idea of substance, an and it has to be stable, simple, without any kinks. Yeah. Then they would probably have a hard time. Remember, this was the Buddha talking to Ananda. He's obviously very experienced. But it gives you an idea. The main thrust of this sutta is not to talk about kasinas or anapanasati. The main thing is just using this idea of emptiness, of what's missing. And notice there's a singleness. You have to emphasize that singleness of perception, which is left when other things are void, is also really important. Because that singleness of perception, if there wasn't a singleness of perception over there, don't worry about it. It's amazing, it's so hard to turn off when it's going like that in public speaking. Now, can you attend to the voidness of the perception of the phone? So it's gone, so thank you. But that's okay, don't worry about it. Happens to us all, except for monks who don't have mobile phones. But it's when that, for that perception of earth to actually to be taken to the next level, it has to be smooth, it has to be even. Similarly, the breath, for that to be taken to the next level, it has to be the singleness of perception of breath. And that's what happens when you get in, out, in, out. That's not singleness. Beginning, middle, end. That's not a singleness of perception. As you've heard me teach, and I'm sure you've got yourself, you get to that point when the breath is just totally even. There's no in or out breath anymore. It's just experience of breath right in this moment, and it doesn't change. There's no in, there's no out, there's no beginning or end. It's just breath. And when you get to that singleness of perception of breath, then it will start to disappear and go to the next level. The same, you have to get like a breath without any valleys or without any mountains, without any peaks, when it's all smoothed out like the hide. Now, if you use that idea on your breath, which I think you probably get more understanding of, now perception of earth has to be similar, that smoothness, so it can disappear. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. It really doesn't matter too much. You know, it's a great question. It does not matter exactly what that perception is, how you see Earth, as long as you have some sort of concept which you can hold in your mind and which is stable. So you may be able to follow that kasina in a totally different way than the lady sitting next to you. But it does not matter. What's really important is that perception in your mind of earth or earthiness, whatever it is something which you can hold and hold for long periods of time. It's the same as that, again, the light limiters, the colour limiters. And it's easy to just to watch it out there. But to close your eyes and to hold it in your mind. And you notice if you do that, it's not the same as the light outside or the picture outside. But it doesn't matter, as long as it's something which is stable, even, you can hold. Okay, great. Good question. Thank you for paying attention. Yeah. World of volition is just gets you going. I remember giving this simile with Bhante years ago. See, what is the role of volition? The role of volition is like the archer. The archer has to have volition to put the arrow in the bow and to pull the string back and to aim it, and then you let it go. And they say, if that arrow carries the volition of the archer until it hits the target. But from the time the archer releases the arrow, he can do nothing else. So, you put your mind in the direction of sort of letting go or of voidness. That is a volition. And then you let it go and let it do its work. I've also said, like sometimes a similar to the taxi driver, take me to the airport. You tell that taxi driver, as you're in the front of this building over here, and that's the end of your volition. the taxi driver should be able to get you there. Yeah. Let it happen, yeah. Exactly. Because if you keep on making volitions all the time, you disturb the whole process. Set it up at the beginning. And again, much of that volition, you know, Chris, you know, so much of the stuff you do in meditation, you know where that volition came from. I embedded it in you. It was brainwashed. But it's beautiful brainwashing. And where did I get it from? Ajahn Chah. So, this is actually how that volition comes from time, from teacher to student to teacher. There is a transmission in Theravada Buddhism. Sometimes we say that's only in Tibetan Buddhism, where we only have transmission from master to student. There is a transmission just by listening to the Dhamma, listening to teachings. That goes into your mind. It's weird. But I've seen that in my own mind. You get to a certain stage in meditation, you know what to do. Where did that come from? You look back, that was from years ago when I was with Ajahn Chah. He said something and I've forgotten all about it. It just comes up at the right time. That's a transmission, yeah. Yeah, that's right. So that's why it's important to come here. I don't think I don't understand it, or this was above me. Forget about all of that. It's in there. And when it's ready, when you're ready, then that words will come up. Well, that means you've got into the wrong meditation class, the wrong church. Then you're big in trouble. So choose your taxi driver, your temple very carefully. Yeah. No, I think good. Well, but you get there eventually. It might just take a little bit longer. Yeah, that's right, yeah. It's aimlessness, I think, that's apanihita. That is the one where you don't direct. And, yeah, I forget what the other one was. But anyway, this is the signless one. Okay, anyway, I think that was enough brainwashing for your minds for one day. And again, a nice sutta. Those are the sorts of ones. Was it recorded? Yeah, okay, it's great it's recorded, because all these things you say, you can always sort of get the recording and listen to it again. When that's where it gets really fun. Okay, great. So let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha now.
Arahaṃ Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Buddhaṃ Bhagavantaṃ abhivādemi Sovākkhāto Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammaṃ namassāmi Suppatipanno Bhagavato Sāvakasaṅgho Saṅghaṃ namāmi